Okay, a formal welcome, and thank you for joining us as we launch this new course called My God. I know it looks like it's cut short. We're used to OMG, and this is just the MG. They didn't ask me, but I'm not sure why they didn't call the course OMG. I'm sure they have their reasons. They certainly thought of it. But thank you for joining us. I know we've had some in-person courses already since COVID, but this is certainly the largest. So it's great to see everybody and be back together. Can I just ask those who are first-time JLI students, could you just raise your hand so we can give you a warm welcome? That's about almost half of the room. So we love Shalom Aleichem. So thank you for joining. I'm sure with God's help, you'll enjoy this course and it won't be your last. I want to thank our friend, Dr. Alan Deutsch, for sponsoring this course generously. We appreciate it very much. And I also want to thank my nephew, Levik Shmatkin, for all of his help in general, including preparing this room for this course tonight. So thank you, Levik. One more thing, and that is that today is the 13th day of Cheshvan, and it's the second yahrzeit of a brother of mine, David Henach. Because of the launch of this course, I'm here today. Otherwise, perhaps I would have joined my family in New York just for the day, but I'm delighted to be here with you. But I do mention his name so that all of our Torah study tonight should be in his memory as well. That's David Henach ben Moshe. One more thing, and that is that for the benefit of everybody, I'm going to try to hold all questions for the end. And I'm not going to be in any rush. I could stay on for as long as you need me after the class. If you have a question that's relevant in order for you to get or understand something right where we are, feel free to indicate so, and I'm glad to take short, quick things during the class. Otherwise, feel free to jot it down, and I'm happy to address them afterwards because it's very easy for a lot of other issues to come up when we're discussing something so massive like God himself. So thank you for that, and with this, we will jump in. There's a story told about an atheist, a Jewish atheist, that is. A Jewish atheist who wasn't able to send his children to a Jewish day school because he's an atheist. But he still had to send them to a private day school, so he sent them to a Catholic school. After about a week, his son comes home and asks his dad, "Tell me, I learned about the Trinity today. What's up with that?" And his dad is getting a little concerned, and he calls him to the side and he says, "Listen up. There's only one God, and we don't believe in him." So this is... if it's possible to arrange seating for a couple, if there's different seats available separately. Thank you very much. Welcome to Vlad and Yana and to Jonathan. Thank you very much for joining us. Vlad and Yana are also first-time JLI students, so let's hear it for them. Welcome. There's seats by the table. Feel free to get comfortable. So this joke illustrates this idea that, first of all, even someone who thinks they're an atheist also believes in God and can't really get away from it. But that we're going to discuss in subsequent lessons. As far as what's relevant for today, Judaism, at its core, embraces the belief in one God. And that's really the very essence of Judaism itself. And this, we know, was discovered by Abraham, our patriarch, the founder of monotheism, who inquired and asked and probed until he came to the conclusion that there is only one God, and embraced this idea himself, as well as began to disseminate this idea and to influence others in this regard, of course, becoming the father of Judaism, but in truth, the father of all three major religions. But the question is, who is this God? We say we believe in one God, but what do we know about this God, and who is this God? That's at the very center of Jewish understanding of everything. So this course is going to give us a fresh understanding about God. We're going to address 25 plus questions. I say 25 because the book is going to present 25 questions, but I'm saying 25 plus because I'm sure all of you are going to contribute with your own questions, which will come up along this journey, and I encourage you to do so, so that we can discuss these things from your perspectives as well. Just a reminder, if you can just turn off your devices so we have no distractions. Thank you very much. So before we actually get into actual questions about God, there is an important preliminary question that we need to address, and that is, other than satisfying our intellectual curiosity, why is it relevant to have a course about God? Why don't we just say we believe in God, and that's it, and we move on in life, and everything's fine? Why do we have to actually ask the questions and discuss and probe, etc., etc., and to seek out answers? So we're going to address this question from a human perspective at first, and that is that human beings in general seem to be biologically hardwired to seek out a connection with something that transcends them, something that goes beyond just who I am as a human being. And in order to, when seeking out meaning and purpose in life, why am I here, asking all the big questions that human beings ask themselves, naturally we end up with something transcendent, something that is beyond ourselves, and we end up talking about God. Now, from a human perspective, that is, we have actual research that highlights this idea, and there's a recent groundbreaking exploration of the neuroscience of spirituality by a New York Times best-selling author who came to these conclusions, although she did not set out to research anything related to spirituality, but she came to this conclusion in the process of her research. And we're going to turn to page 3 in your student books, to text number 1. And I'm going to ask Shelley on my left to please be our first reader today. I may move around the room when we bump into texts that need to be read. Most of them are shorter in this class. If you don't want to read, feel free to just pass the figurative microphone over to the next person next to you. Let's take it away, please, with text number 1.
The awakened brain. Each of us is endowed with the natural capacity to perceive a greater reality and consciously connect to the life force that moves in, through, and around us. Whether or not we participate in a spiritual practice or adhere to a faith tradition, whether or not we identify as religious or spiritual, our brain has a natural inclination toward and docking station for spiritual awareness. The awakened brain is a neural circuitry that allows us to see the world more fully and thus enhance our individual, societal, and global well-being. I didn't set out to study spirituality per se. My discovery of the awakened brain began with the desire to understand human resilience and help people who were struggling. Bit by bit, striking data points and my patient's stories of hurt and healing helped me see that spiritual experience was a vital, though overlooked, component of healing. I've discovered that the awakened brain is both inherent to our physiology and invaluable to our health and functioning.
Thank you, Shelley. So this question that we must first address is, why is it important to deepen our understanding of God? So as far as the general human interest, humans have a need to feel accomplished and achieved, and they look to the spiritual realms to meet this need. This spiritual experience is a vital component of healing, as we just read from Dr. Lisa Miller. So that's from a human perspective. But then from a Jewish religious perspective, why is it important to engage in what we're doing tonight and for the subsequent 5 Monday evenings? Why are we discussing God? Why are we asking questions? So you would think that for Jews, we believe in God and that's it. We should just leave it at that. But the truth is that if we fell short of trying to understand God intellectually, we would actually be leaving out a very important component of who we are. Let's go to text number 2. Linda, please. This is from the author of the Tanya, founder of the Chabad School of Thought, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi.
The entirety of human existence and purpose is to gain intimate knowledge of God's glory and majestic splendor, each individual to the extent of their intellectual capacity. This goal is stated in the Zohar. God created the world in order that they may know him.
Thank you very much. That's a powerful statement. God created the world. In other words, the very purpose of why we are here is that we may know God, that we should get to know God. So asking questions about God is not something that's relegated to an atheist or a skeptic, but rather, for all of us, if we want to know God, we have to ask questions. That's the only way to come to know God, is by asking questions. So we question all of our current assumptions in order to arrive at an even deeper understanding than what we are able to relate to at present. So from a Jewish interest, as we just read, understanding God to the extent possible is the purpose of our being. And that's, again, it's a pretty big statement that we're here to get to know God. Additionally, as we will read in text number 3, and I'm going to ask Sid if you can please read that for us. And this takes us back about 1,000 years to a great sage, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, in his work, Emunot Videot. And let's see what he has to say.
We engage in philosophical and intellectual probes of the principle of our faith for 2 reasons. First, to intellectually confirm that which we already know, having been so informed by God's prophets. Second, to empower ourselves to respond to those who take issue with our beliefs.
Thank you. So from the Jewish perspective, why do we engage in trying to understand God? Because we already accept God as a thing. We believe in God. But now we want to try to understand what we already believe in. Yes, we believe in it. That's not a question. That's our conviction. It's our faith. Now the question is, can I intellectually also relate and resonate with what I already believe in? So Rabbi Sadia Gaon, point number 1 was exactly this, that in order for us to understand what we already accept with faith, that's reason number 1 to engage in this process. And number 2, he said, because if we just believe in God with simple faith, which is great, but what if somebody approaches us and starts asking us questions? We may not be equipped with the tools to be able to take them on and answer their questions. And their questions may even reflect back on us and cast doubt on what we already believe in. So in order to be equipped with the tools to be able to respond to a heretic, so we should understand, meaning go beyond just faith and understand God, and that way we will have the tools with what to respond. Now, one last point on this, and that is that if we just have faith in God, then I'm pointing to A here on the screen. Am I blocking you, Tom?
Can you see?
So A is to create a harmonious relationship in which our soul and mind work in tandem. If I just believe in God and that's it, then my mind is basically not really on the same page as my soul. So belief in God, faith in God may resonate with me in my soul, but where's my mind? My mind is totally doing its own thing. It's not part of the It's not part of my relationship with God. And that's a problem, because a human being's greatest asset is our mind. And our mind needs to be part of this process. To leave it outside of our faith experience is to leave the most important part of us untouched by our relationship with God. So we need our mind to be on the same page as what we already accept and feel within our soul. So that is just some general preliminary thoughts on why we are even here, why we are engaging in this endeavor tonight and for the rest of this course. I hope these ideas resonated so far. Now, we're going to advance and we're going to ask many questions. As I said, 25 questions over this course, at least. Today, we're going to be addressing four questions. Number one, what is God? Number two, where is God? Number three, how did God come to be? Where does he come from? And number four, is God a he, a she, or a they? That's going to be the fourth for tonight. Okay, everyone ready? All right, let's advance. So we're going to be asking many questions, and these questions stem not from doubt, but from love and respect. Anyone that you're in a relationship with, anyone that you know, and you love and respect, you want to get to know them even better. So out of our love and respect for God, we want to engage in this process so that we can get to know God, who we love and respect, even better than we know him up until now. Okay, so question number one for tonight is, what is God? And for that, we're going to turn our attention to the screen.
So, you want to know more about God? Let's start with your current conception of God. Is he a big, mighty guy in the sky, tugging at the puppet strings of the universe? Does he spend his days golfing with the righteous on lush heaven greens? Is he angry and vengeful, or wise and kind? We all have conceptions of God picked up along our developing years. But before we delve into secrets of God's being, we need to do some inner household cleaning. You see, thousands of years ago, young Abraham had a similar problem. At the time, people were searching for coherence in a universe that seemed random. So they devised an elaborate system of multiple powers who each were responsible for a different function. If you got the rain god happy, you got more rain. If the sun god was pleased, you got more sun for your crops. Then the wise men decided that each god was associated with a figure and shape, an idol that you could conveniently buy from your local idol shop. And these figurines had the power to grant or deny your deepest needs and wishes. Abraham's father, Terah, had just such a shop, and he made the mistake of asking Abraham to man the sales floor for a day. An old woman walked in. "Young man, an idol, please, for my arthritis. Which of these gods is good for my knees?" "How old are you?" Abraham asked. 60, replied the woman. "You poor thing," Abraham said. 60 years old and bowing down to an object that was made yesterday. Embarrassed, the woman slinked away. Next, a woman came in with a plate filled with fine flour. "Take this, young man, and offer it to the idols." But Abraham had a different idea. He took a club and smashed all the idols. He then put the club in the hand of the largest idol. When Terah came to the store, he was furious. "What have you done to the idols?" "I must be honest with you," Abraham responded. "A woman came with a plate of fine flour and asked me to offer it to them. When I set it before them, one of the idols exclaimed, 'I'm starving. I will eat first.' Another quickly protested, 'No, I will eat first.' That started a huge fight. What a scene! The largest idol then stood up, grab that club and smash the rest of them. Are you mocking me? Terra shouted. Do the idols have any awareness? Abraham smiled. Exactly. Abraham went on to teach people what God is not. Before humanity could begin to know what God is, they had to unlearn their crooked conception of him. We are not so different from school or from home or from Hollywood. We ingest portraits of God that stay stuck in stone, not growing with us as we mature and our intelligence blossoms. If and when we decide we want to expand our understanding of God, we must first do what Abraham did. We have to unlearn before we learn. Before constructing God, we need to deconstruct.
Okay, so as we just saw in the video, and by the way, the story was based on a midrash recorded a couple thousand years ago in Jewish literature. And like Abraham, we too first need to unknow the God of our current perception. Like Abraham needed to deconstruct the society, the prevailing perception of God that existed in his time. He needed to deconstruct that before he began to construct the God that he had come to discover. We also need to do the same. We have to embark on a similar process because a lot of our conceptions may be childish and they may be incorrect. So we're going to do a little deconstructing before we construct. The first thing that we need to deconstruct is the notion that we can understand God. If we think that we can understand God, the first thing we've come here to learn is that we can't. We cannot understand God. Are you kidding me? Now that we had to come here for you to tell me that we're not even going to get to know God? So there's a difference. We are not going to understand God, but we're going to get to know a lot of things about God. So God himself is totally aloof, transcendent, and beyond comprehension. In fact, one of the names that we use often to refer to God is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. But what does Kadosh mean? Anyone know what the word Kadosh means? Holy. But literally, it means something else. In fact, marriage means Kiddushin, the same word. What does that mean?
Separate.
Exactly. To separate. When you marry one person, you are separating that individual from the rest of the world. When you say that something is holy, you are separating its status from everything else within it, within reality. When you say that God is holy, what you're saying is that he stands alone. He's separate in his status as the Holy One. So this name tells us that God himself can't be known because he is separate. He is in a realm and reality of his own. So, as we see here, we know a lot about God, but he himself is unknowable. And that's the first thing we're doing in our deconstruction. Let's take a look at text number 5. Lou, if you're okay reading that, please. It's on page 10 in your student book. And this comes from Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, who was the Maharal.
Our sages purposefully refer to God as Kadosh, the Holy One, because God's truest self is unknowable, detached from and beyond every form of physicality, body, or any other existing entity. It is therefore appropriate to refer to God as the Holy One, for the term Kadosh is used for an entity that is removed. Our sages, in their great wisdom, informed us of this truth through referring to God as HaKodesh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. Implying that God is simple and transcends all that exists, they intentionally chose a negative term to refer to God, which does not identify what he is, but rather denotes what he transcends all that exists.
Thank you. This brings to mind the parable that's well known of a group of blind men who lived together in this town, and they learned that there's this new animal that came to town that's called an elephant. But of course, they're not able to see it, so they didn't really know what it was. But each one of them started to touch it, of course, to touch they're capable of. So one of them touches the trunk, and he says, well, this must be a thick snake. Another one touches the leg, and he says, this must be a pillar. While another one touches the side of the elephant and says, this must be a wall. What all of them have in common is that they all knew something about the elephant, but nobody really was able to identify the elephant itself. So in our scenario as well, we're going to be discussing a lot of ideas about God, but again, I'm highlighting the word about. We're going to be learning about God, but God himself will remain unknown. He'll remain holy, sanctified, and transcendent, and ultimately unknowable, because God is detached from every form of physicality. And finally, one last thought. So God created man in his image, and you may have heard this said before, we returned the favor and created God in our image. Of course, that's a problem when that happens, because when we conjure up an image of how we view God and create a perception of God in our own image, that's a problem. So we need to know that we never could understand him, and any image that we do give ourselves for our understanding of God is ultimately going to be falling short, and therefore we need to let go of these conceptions before we do anything else. And just finally, we must recognize our blindness in this area, just like those individuals who were trying to identify the elephant and they couldn't. Jews are especially susceptible to idolatry because of their desire for spiritual experiences. So we're not going to actually read the texts of 6a and 6b. I encourage you to do so later. We have a lot to cover in the short time that we're together tonight. But they're from Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who just passed away about 2 years ago, a huge modern-day sage and commentator on the Talmud. And he wrote that he has this theory that Jews are especially susceptible to idolatry because of their desire for spiritual experiences. Why don't they turn to their own belief system? So you may be aware that Jews are they're very good customers for various different, every revolution was either started by a Jew or Jews joined. Every ism, Jews jump on. Any new movement, Jews are the first ones to jump on it. In fact, cults, Eastern religions, such a significant percentage of their members are Jews. Why is that? Why are Jews such vulnerable, why are they so at risk for these things? And that's because, Rabbi Steinsaltz suggests, that it's so difficult to relate to a God who is an abstraction. Because we believe in an invisible God that we can't see and we can't really know fully, so that's why we struggle with it and therefore try to grab on to any opportunity that we can to like concretize our association and understanding and perception of God. We grab on to any opportunity that we have to do so. And this is why Jews fall prey to a lot of these movements and ideas. Idolatry is an attempt of simple people to give a form to the divine image, leading to a more concrete type of relationship. So with that, we come to a close for our first question. So back to our question, what is God? The answer is that we don't know what God is, and we won't know what God is. However, we can only understand things about him, and the big word here is about. And that's exactly what we are embarking on going forward tonight and in the future lessons. Everything good so far?
Great.
Okay, wonderful. So, with that.
So there applies to him. You also have that fourth question, was it the he, she, or they? That applies by that answer to him. So, I don't know if that you answered two questions.
Well, we're just.
That's a hint of things to come. But.
Well, we know that we use him, and we'll come to it at the fourth question, but who said? Who said it's correct?
Right there.
Doesn't mean it's correct.
It's in red, highlighted.
We'll come to that. We will come to that. So, question number two. Where is God?
That's been my question the whole time that we've been talking so far, because they use it in the masculine form. Maybe that question should have been in the first part.
But we first need a little information of question one, two, three before we can embrace the fourth. And we also want you to stay fresh and awake till the end of the class. So, if I can ask you to please open your student books to page 13, to exercise 1.1. Before we do that, there's a joke about this, there was this town who had, among other things, it used to be in these Jewish villages, everybody knew everybody, and there was a town ganef, and a town drunk, and a town this, and a town that. There were these two boys, ages 8 and 10, very mischievous. Everybody knew. Any trouble in town was immediately associated and attributed to them. Parents didn't know what to do with them. Anyway, eventually they say, you know what, I'm going to call the rabbi to come pay a visit to our house and to talk to them. Maybe he could knock some sense into them. He sits down with the first one at the dining room table, and he looks at him, and he really had a real, authentic rabbinic look, not like the compromised ones you're getting over here. And he looks at the boy, and he says, "Where is God?" The boy is like looking at him, and he doesn't know what to say or what to do. And he looks at the rabbi, looks at him again, and he says, "Where is God?" No answer from the boy. Third time, the rabbi pounds on the table, "Where is God?" The boy doesn't know what to do. He jumps out of his seat, runs upstairs to his bedroom, and hides in the closet. His brother sees that he just ran into the closet. He follows him. And the brother says to him, "We're in trouble." He says, "Why? What do you mean?" So the rabbi said that God is missing and he thinks we did it. So, to find out where is God, again, I'm going to ask you to turn to exercise 1.1. And in the box below, would you draw a representation of the world, just something quick, then add a representation for God by writing God or some other symbol somewhere on it. Okay, if you're done, if you don't mind sharing with us, we're on this world that you painted. Where did you place God?
Around the entire thing.
Raise of hand, how many of you put God around the whole thing? Okay, anyone do anything different? What did you do?
Center. I had him. In the earth also, outside and inside.
Okay, both. Anyone else, quickly?
Above.
Any other aboves? Okay, excellent. Embrace. What's that?
Embrace.
So everything, kind of. Okay, thank you for sharing that. As usual, when we study Torah, you're all right. And now we'll look into the sources. So, where is God? We have two depictions of God's location when we look into Jewish sources. And we take a look at text number 7, which is a verse from Deuteronomy. Karen, can I trouble you to please read that verse for us? Kind of a well-known verse.
"Gaze down from the heavens, your holy dwelling place, and bless your people Israel."
Okay, anyone know these words in Hebrew? Hashkifa mime'on kadshecha min hashamayim. Those are some of the few words I actually know how to sing them from the Torah. But it's in the middle of the mitzvah of Bikurim, which is about the first fruit, and giving the first fruit and bringing them up to the temple, but we're not getting into that now. But the point is that it says, gaze down from the heavens. These are the words of the Torah, of the Bible itself. which means that God is in the heavens. Okay? And we use that term a lot, by the way. When we say that someone is God-fearing in Hebrew, he's called a Yirei Shamayim, fear of heaven. Anyone know how to say God in Yiddish? Erica. Eibishter. Ever heard of that? The Eibishter means the one above. Again, looking upward. If somebody like wants to like turn his eyes to God, you look heavenward. But in addition to that, we have another source, and that's in text number 8. Todd, can you get that one for us, please? That's from the book of Isaiah and talks about the prayers of the angels, which we actually incorporate in our own daily prayers. Let's hear it.
Holy, holy, holy is the God of the heavenly host. The entire world is filled with his glory.
So that's the key words there, the last words. Melo chal haaretz kivodo. Right? All familiar words from our prayers. That God is everywhere because his glory fills the entire earth, the whole universe, the entire world. So we have God in the heavens and we have God as everywhere, both from credible biblical sources. So which one is it? So let's take it, let's try to analyze. So let's start with the heavens, because that's the one we quoted first. Could we say that God is in the heavens? So we can say it, and we do say it. But could we say that God is only in the heavens? Obviously, that's a problem, because we can't limit God and relegate him to the heavens only, because God is everywhere. He's omnipresent. If he's everywhere, he's not only in the heavens. Okay? So we can't say that he's only there. So that falls short. But the truth is, let's go to the other term, that God is everywhere. Is that sufficient? Could that work? The problem is that describing God as being everywhere is also somewhat deficient. And we will see why. And here we're going to get a little bit of a deep idea here. So in the heavens limits God and contradicts our belief that God is omnipresent. Everywhere is another problem, because we're confining God to a created space. And now, join me here. This lectern right in front of me, okay? It fills a particular space, just like the table right in front of you. So let me ask you, what comes first? What's more primary, the space or this lectern? Obviously, the space is more primary, because the lectern, I brought it over here and I can also wheel it out of the room right now. But can I move the space away from here? I can't. The space is here and this lectern fills the space. So you can imagine the space without the lectern, but you can't imagine the lectern without the space. Okay? So when we talk about God, when we say that God is everywhere, even though we have the best intentions when we say so, that God is everywhere, but what we're really doing is limiting him. And stick with me here. We're confining God to a space. What does that mean? When we say God is everywhere, what does that sound like? What's primary and what's secondary? Just like we said before about the table. It sounds like the space is primary, and God now arrived in this space. And now he's everywhere and he fills the space fully. But that still is saying that the everywhere was first and God is second. And is that correct? Could we say that God arrived to a space? No, that would be incorrect. We can't say that.
He created that space.
He created that space. Thank you. Now, anyone know how to say space in Hebrew? Makom. Anyone know that word? The word makom is actually one of God's names. I'm not sure if you knew that. And I'll even challenge you that you've actually used that name of God, maybe in English, but traditionally when we are in the house of a mourner, there are some words that we say to comfort the mourner. What's the first word of that Hebrew phrase? Hamakom, which is referring to God. May God comfort and console you. Why are we calling God the space? The space should comfort you? Come on, God has many other names. Why don't we use one of those? What does it mean? Why do we refer to God as the space? So we have a very short but very powerful line. Sam, I'm going to ask you to read it for us, if you're okay. Page 14, text number 9, and this comes from the Midrash. Go ahead, please.
God is the space of the universe. The universe is not the space of God.
Let's read that again. God is the space of the universe. The universe is not the space of God. It's not that there was a space and God arrived on the scene. Of course not. It's not that the space holds or contains God. That can't be. It's God who's primary, and God contains the space. So God holds up all of space, not the other way around. So to say God is everywhere becomes incorrect, because that's like saying everywhere was first and everywhere contains God. But it's the other way around. God is what carries the space and contains it and was here first. Space, so to speak, came onto God's scene, not the other way around. So one of the names of to describe God is Makom, space. God holds the world and enables it to exist. So where is God? What would be the correct answer to this question? Of course, in the heavens, not really. Everywhere, also not really.
Wherever he wants to be.
The correct way to say it would be is that everywhere is in God. Not that God is everywhere, because that makes everywhere primary. And that's wrong. God is primary. So everywhere is in God would be the correct answer to this question. Now, everyone following? Okay, so if you come back to the drawing that you made on the piece of paper, by the way, it would be like God is the paper itself. The whole world that you drew onto that paper is landing on God's space. It would be like God is the very paper itself that you drew the world on. So, Shelley alluded to this, but there is a known Hasidic Rebbe by the name of the Rebbe of Kotsk. I think some of my ancestors come from that dynasty, actually. And he was known for his sharp wit, the Kotsk Rebbe. And he once asked his students, where is God? And he got all kinds of answers, profound, brilliant. And then he said that God is wherever you let him in. Because ultimately, yes, we could say God is everywhere and God is in everywhere, etc., etc. But ultimately, how am I going to encounter God? It's going to be if I open myself up to God and allow him into my awareness. And that's the most important and relevant where question to ask. Where is God? Wherever we let him in, because we all experience divine providence every day. The question is, if we're aware and alert to what we're experiencing, as far as the hand of God is concerned, sometimes we're more open to divine awareness, sometimes less so. But the most important question of where is God is going to be the answer that we give for ourselves. Are we paying attention? Are we alert? Are we allowing God into our own personal space, so to speak? So God is everywhere. Let's open ourselves up and let him in. That brings our second question to a close. Any quick comments or questions? Yes, Larry.
If he's everywhere, there's no need to let him in.
He could be everywhere, but as far as he's right in front of me too. The question is if I'm allowing him into my own personal consciousness.
Okay.
We can live our life and be closed to God's presence and God's existence. And some people live their whole life that way. We have to make the conscious decision to open ourselves up to him. Yes.
So does that mean that you have the power or God has the power? Of course God has the power, I know that. But I'm saying if you let him in, if you have to let God in, then who has the power?
That's the definition of free will.
God has the power, and we'll certainly be addressing this more in later classes. Of course, God has the power. Really, what you're asking is who initiates, really, and who opens themselves up to who. And there's a lot to that, and it's true about any relationship, right? Who, when one is smiling, it's a very good chance you'll get a smile back from the other. So God, generally, of course, everything is in God's hands. The power is with God. But yet, I still need to make, God wants us to also play a role and to contribute to the process. So we need to open ourselves up to some degree, even a crack, and God's presence will be felt. All right, so let's move along. Let's move along here. We discussed that. So where is God? Where are we allowing God into our lives? Let's open ourselves up and let him in. Question number 3, and this is a biggie. How did God come to be? Any of your kids ever ask you that question? Who created God? So, take a sip of your drink if you have one. Okay. So, asking the question of, like, where are you from? Where'd you come from? Who are your parents? Very normal, right? We meet somebody and we kind of want to get to know them. We start asking them questions to kind of appreciate who they are, where you came from, but who you came from, who created you, so to speak, who brought you into the world. And that's very normal. What's your background? You know, we kind of want to appreciate the person, so we start asking questions. And of course, if we want to be in a genuine relationship with God, we're going to ask this question too. Where does God come from? It's a very valid question. So we need to, we're asking the question, but we need to analyze it a little bit. The question, how did God come to be, is usually driven by what we can call a meta question, a question behind the question. Why do we even have the question of where did God come from? Because we look around the world, and we look at the universe, and we look at creations so magnificent, so complex, etc., etc., and all of its majestic detail, and you start asking, where did this come from? And you come to the conclusion that just like nothing could just create itself, no book was ever authored spontaneously, the world can't either just exist because it does. It has to come from somewhere. From something. Every effect, there has to be a cause which brought about any effect. So the world points you in the direction of a creator. So now when you come to the conclusion that there is a creator, then you come to this question of where does God come from? How did God come to be? So the existence of our universe tells us something. Where did it come from? The creator. And therefore, we want to know, where did the Creator come from? So, just to keep pointing to the next thing and say, well, God created this, and who created God? Something else created God. It doesn't really answer our question, because then we're going to want to know who created that, and then who created that. There's a well-known scientist, a great scientist, who once gave this talk all about the universe and the cosmos, etc., etc. At the end of his talk, this little old lady stands up and says, everything that you just said is all rubbish. I know exactly what the world stands on. He said, the whole world sits on the back of a huge turtle. Well, the scientist didn't really want to, let her down, but he just said, so tell me. And what is that turtle resting on? And she said, well, a turtle even larger than that. So he said, and that one? And she said, it's turtles all the way down. So just to say that something created something is going to lead us to say that something created that, etc., etc. So it's not going to really get us anywhere. So we come to God. Now we have to understand, where does God come from? And the answer is that there are two very different, categorically different existences in the world. Okay, there's God, and then there's everything else. Let me ask you this. The holy iPhone. Who created the iPhone? Steve Jobs. Who invented the light bulb? Who developed the airplane? By the way, they say the first airplane only made right turns. Now let me ask you another question. Thank you, Sam. I know. Who invented the mathematical equation 2 plus 2 equals 4? Which professor designed this principle of mathematics? And the answer is that that's a ridiculous question, because nobody creates 2 plus 2 equals 4. It just is. Are you following me? An iPhone needs to be invented. It needs to be created. But 2 plus 2 equals 4 doesn't need to be created. It just needs to be discovered. And sometimes you hear it from a teacher, sometimes you discover it on your own. But it's just something to be discovered, not something that needed to be created. In a similar vein, God is a being about whom there could be no discussion of who created God. Because there's two types of created beings, or there's two types of existences. You could look on page 16 in figure 1.3, which kind of breaks it up and gives you the two different categories. There's everything that exists in the world, and then there's God. Everything that exists in the world, we're going to call that is dependent on something else. It's an effect that needed a cause. Meaning, it could be here, and it could also not be here. That's true about everything within existence. That's true about everything, with the exception of God. God is not a maybe, maybe not. Everything else could be here, and could also not be here. And possibly won't be here at a certain time. It could have been created, and it could have not been created. It's contingent on something else. It's dependent on something else. God is the only thing which Jewish philosophers call a necessary existence. God is the only existence that truly exists, that is not dependent or contingent on anything else. So let's take a look here. So where did the Creator come from? An effect indicates that there must be a cause. We advance by realizing that the Creator isn't an effect at all, and so he requires no cause at all. So something that came to be, something that's an effect, needs a cause. But God isn't an effect, so he doesn't need a cause. Nobody brought God into being, because God is the only existence which we're calling is a necessary existence. The definition of God is that he exists and always did exist. He just is. He cannot be created. He can only be discovered. Just like 2 plus 2 equals 4. Didn't need to be created. Obviously, we're talking about God himself. But this gives us an idea of a concept within that reality, within that realm. So God, too, can only be discovered. God is a necessary existence, an existence that must be, and therefore has no cause. Because without God, there is no other existence. So God is not an existence that is contingent. There's no option if God should exist or not exist. Everything else, yes, not God. I know this is a little bit of an abstract idea to wrap our minds around. But let's try to illustrate this, actually turning to the Bible itself. This idea is so foundational that it was part of God's first communication to Moses. Okay, this takes us to the book of Exodus. And Larry, yes. If I can ask you to please read text 10a. which are the verses of the very first exchange between Moses and God when God is appointing Moses to his job to go to Egypt and redeem the Jewish people from Egypt. This is the backdrop of where this conversation picks up.
Moses said to God, "When I come to the children of Israel and inform them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, they will respond, 'What is his name? What should I tell them?'"
Okay, so Moses is being sent to the Jewish people. He says to God, "Well, I'm going to arrive. They're going to ask me, what you're talking about this God, what's his name? So I need an answer from you, God." So before we even say another word, there are names that are random. Okay, if I call my dog Charlie, I could have also given him a different name. I could have called him Falafel. Somebody's dog is actually named Falafel, by the way. So the name, someone local, the name doesn't say anything about the dog. It could have had this name. Now that it has this name, so it refers to this dog, I could have given him a different name. Other names are actually expressive. They say something about the object. So let's just say I have an electric heater here, and I'm calling it an electric heater. So that name is very expressive. It actually tells me what the function of this thing is. I can't just call it something else. It wouldn't do justice to the function of this thing. So when Moses is asking God, "I need a name because the people are going to ask me what your name is," he's obviously not asking him for a Charlie because that's not going to express anything. He wants to know a name of God that's actually going to convey something about God when he gives this name to the people. Pick up with 10b, Larry, please, being that you started.
God replied to Moses, "Eleah, Asher, Eleah."
Thank you. So in the Hebrew, God responds to Moses three words. What is God's name? In Hebrew, it's Eyeh Asher Eyeh. What does that mean? So the root of the word Eyeh is from the word Haya. Anyone know what Haya is in Hebrew? Was. Yeah, thank you. Exactly. That's Haya. In other words, we could say that Haya really means to exist. It means that something is or something was. It means that it exists. So it's derived from the root word Haya, which means to exist. The word Asher means that. So what is God saying to Moses? What's my name? This is how it translates into English. My name is the existing being that is the existing being, or the existence that exists. So if they're going to ask you who I am, tell them that I am the existence that exists. Now, we just said that that name has to be conveying something really important about God, because this is like his answer to the people when they ask him who sent you. So what's going on here? What's embedded in these words? What is God saying, and what's Moses going to tell the people? What he's saying is, he's saying that he starts with I am, right? But he doesn't say anything about himself. Let's say, if you ask me, who are you? I may say I am a rabbi, I am a father, I am whatever. A list of things, and any of you would give a list of things when you're asked the question of tell me about yourself. I am what? But God doesn't continue with I am all-powerful, all-knowing, everywhere. He doesn't say any of that. He says, I am the existence that exists. So it must be that these words are really conveying something really deep and really important. And what is that? So the message is that God's most outstanding quality is that he exists. He's saying something, and that something is the most important thing that the people need to know about God. When you get to Egypt, they're going to ask you who sent you. What's God's name? God's answering him. That answer has to be the most important thing that they need to know about God. What is that? What is he saying to them? Let's take a look at text 11. Dan, would you like to read that for us, please? On page 18, and these are words from Maimonides, about 800 years ago. Sorry.
This phrase conveys that God's existence is not an ordinary existence. We could summarize that the concept as such. God is the existence that exists. In other words, he is an essential and absolute rather than contingent existence.
Thank you. So God is an essential existence, not a contingent existence. And that is what these words convey. So, did this idea come across? So the question of, sorry, let's catch up here on the screen. So who am I? God is telling Moses. I am, he doesn't say this actually. He doesn't say I'm all powerful or the creator. What does he say? I am the existing being that is the existing being. Which means he's saying to Moses, tell the people that I exist in a way that no other creation exists. I exist like no other being exists. Everything else needs something to create it. I don't need anything to create me. Everything else is dependent on something else. Everything else is an effect coming from a cause. I have no cause. I exist because I exist, unlike any other being. God's most outstanding quality is that he exists, or the way he exists, which is different than everything else.
And that's part of our faith.
At the very core of it, yes. And this is what makes God, God. If God wasn't this type of existence, if God was an effect, he wouldn't be God. If God came from something else, he wouldn't be God. The thing he came from would become God.
Is this what separates us from other religions in the world? Are there other religions where their gods have the cause and effect?
Well, first of all, I'm not an expert on other religions. But some variations, but the belief in one God is at the core of the three major religions, yes. But then there's some distinctions, for sure. But again, it's on top of this core essential idea. So they tell a story about, anyone ever hear of a town called Chelm? A Chelm story? How would you describe that? It's like this town, this village that was known for like, not to be a community of brilliant people, let's just say. And anyway, they heard that there's this new invention called the train, and they couldn't believe it because they never saw a train in their life, and they couldn't believe that something like it exists. So they appointed an ambassador, a messenger from their community, to go travel to the big city and find out if it's a real thing or if it's just a rumor. So they sent this one guy, and he went to Warsaw. Lo and behold, he's at the station, and this train is coming into the station. Couldn't believe it. Goes over to the conductor, starts asking questions, tell me how it works, and he explains him everything. The conductor then sees that this guy is running around looking everywhere on the train. He's looking under, he's looking on top, he goes inside, he's looking under the seats, looking in the compartments, wherever. Any door he could open, he asks him, what are you doing? He said, listen, I heard everything you have to say, but there's got to be a little horse somewhere that's pulling this thing. What this tells us is that for us to think that there has to be something where God is coming from basically turns us into a member of the Chelm community who insisted that there has to be some horse pulling the train. So with this, we answer this question, which is question number 3. So how did God come to be? Insisting on looking for God's cause means we are stuck in our own box of creating God in our own image. This is just another way, or another one of those perceptions that we need to deconstruct, being convinced that God comes from something, or there needs to be something that God is coming from, is creating God in our own image, because God is a category of his own, unlike everything else that we know about, which comes from something. God doesn't come from anything. God exists because he exists, and that is the core of everything else. Are we good? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So with this, we go over to our final question for tonight, and that is God a he, a she, or a they? Now, the truth is, this question really shouldn't even be a question. After everything that we discussed tonight, we already said that God is beyond, God is separate, we'll never really know God. God doesn't have any a body or form or anything, so why are we even bothering with this question? Of course God doesn't have a gender. If he doesn't have a body, he doesn't have a gender. So where does this question even come from?
Probably from the answer, we're created in his image.
We are created in his image, or we create him in our image, or you're saying that we're created in God's image. Therefore, if male and female exists within humanity, that's
correct.
Thank you, Sam. That's great. And we're actually going to quote that very verse in just a minute. So good thinking. Exactly. So the question is not if God has a gender. Of course, nobody here thinks so. Certainly not after the last hour of our discussion. So why are we asking the question? The question really is one of terminology. Because if you were in synagogue on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur, you may have heard a song being sung. Avinu Malkeinu. Ever heard those words before? Avinu Malkeinu. What does that mean?
Our Father,
our King. Why aren't we singing our Mother, our Queen? So that's the question. That God doesn't have a gender. That we're all agreeable on that. But if that's the case, why is so much of the terminology we use male-oriented, like the example I just gave you? So, after everything we've learned so far, this shouldn't even be a question. Clearly, God is genderless. So why then is God described almost exclusively in male terms? So, to say that the authors of the Bible and the prayer book were human beings, therefore sexist, would be a foolish thing to suggest, because if this were true, anything we consider valuable would be described in masculine terms. But the truth is that that's not the case at all. Entities that are described as feminine in the Torah, the Jewish nation, the Torah, the divine human soul, the land of Israel, the Sabbath, are all referred to in feminine terminology. The Shabbat queen, you ever heard of that? It's in our prayers. So if the authors were just male-oriented, then that wouldn't exist. So the truth is that we can't just blame it on that. So there's a technical suggestion to this question. Now, I'm not an expert on Hebrew language, but in Hebrew, all nouns are ascribed a gender. Uniquely, unlike in English, every noun has a gender in Hebrew. So, if we're going to be using a term in Hebrew, it can't just be gender neutral. It always has a gender. So, by default, you're never going to have something that just has neither, because the word it actually doesn't even exist in Hebrew. And if you're going to say it, you're going to have to choose either ze or zot. One is male, one is female. So the gender neutral mode in Hebrew is actually masculine. So this is a factor, but it's not really a satisfactory answer to this question. It's just something that's worthwhile to know, but it can't be the complete truth. Number one, it ignores the exactitude of the Torah. If things are said in a certain way, you can't just say, well, it's like a language thing. It has to be more of a thematic thing. There has to be meaning to it and depth to it. It can't just be because those are the words that are used. And number two, if we're choosing, why not choose feminine terms? So if we're saying that Hebrew has to have a gender, then why is it most of the time male? Let it be female as well. So it doesn't really answer the question. We need something more satisfactory. And this is where we come to what Sam enlightened us to before. And that is, on page 20 in your book, we have the verse from Genesis, where we talk about the dual image of God. Where are we? Heather, would you like to read that for us, please? Text number 12. Thank you. So do we hear what was just said here? God created the human in his image. Okay. And then what do we say? Male and female, he created them. So God created the human being, male and female, but that human being was in God's image. So if male and female manifest within the human being, everything about the human being comes from God. We're a reflection of God in many other ways. And by the way, in the process of this course of discussing God from so many different perspectives, we're also going to get to know and have to gain a lot of insight about ourselves throughout this course. But here too, if God created the human with male and female, it must be that within himself, the image from which the human was created, there also has to be male and female. Otherwise, how could God create something in his image that has male and female? If he doesn't have it, God could create anything, but don't say that it's in his image if it doesn't have, if they don't reflect each other. So they do. So what does this mean? So nonetheless, it certainly still doesn't mean that God has a gender, male or female. So yet we're still using these terms. So the clear implication is that God is both male and female, which means not that he doesn't have either, but that he's both. Now, when we say that God is both, again, it doesn't mean that God himself has a gender. What it does mean is that God has both modalities, if you will. God could express himself or operate in the modality of male, and he can also do the same as female. Now, let's read the words of Nachmanides. We'll actually give Manny to read those words because he likes Nachmanides. Text number 13 on page 20, please.
All divine names and attributes appear on occasion in each gender. Thus, our sages regularly refer to the divine presence, the Shekhinah, in the feminine. The divine names appear in both feminine and masculine forms because God's invisible unity is revealed within this plurality, and they are all unified within God's unity.
Thank you. So already Nachmanides is telling this to us 800 years ago, roughly. So when we refer to God in the masculine form, as we usually do, we are referring to God as he manifests or behaves in a masculine manner. And the same is true when it comes to a female or female terminology. It's God manifesting himself in that way. Now, when you talk about male and female, as we have here in the verse, text 14, therefore man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So when normally, and this is, by the way, how the first human being was created. The first human being was created as one entity that had both male and female. And then they were split. This is why we say when we get married, we are finding our soulmate. Why do we refer to it as a soulmate? Because our soul was once united with that soul. We were both parts of one soul, the male component and the female component. They were split. They both went into separate bodies in this world, male and female. And then when they find each other, it's a reunion. And it's the two halves of the same soul coming back together. So when we talk about the unity of male and female, what do we find? That the male is the giver. The male is the giver. And the female is the receiver. And the Kabbalah discusses this a lot at great length. and it talks about the larger respective roles of male and female, as you could say, benefactor and recipient, or perhaps a better term would be, we could say that the male is the initiator and the female is the cultivator. So the male contributes a seed, but the female is what is who cultivates that seed and turns it into a full-blown human being.
Sounds biological.
Exactly, but why does it manifest this way in this realm and this in our reality? Because it's a reflection and manifestation of what's going on above. Because God too has both of these components. Now, you may have heard that God and the Jewish people are referred to as husband and wife. In fact, Revelation on Mount Sinai, when we receive the Torah, is considered to be the marriage between God and the Jewish people. It's going strong for 3,300 years, by the way. And we're still into him, and he's still into us. In text 15, we have a one-line verse, two words, from the Mishnah that refers to this event as a marriage. On the day of his marriage, this refers to the day of the giving of the Torah. So, if we take this marriage analogy a little bit further, we find something really astounding. That, so when we refer to God, back up and drop, when we refer to God as male, which we do so much in our prayers, for example, that's because it's all in the context of the relationship between us and God, between God and us humans. And that is husband and wife. So that's in the context of God being the provider and we being the receivers who take what God, we take what God gives us, and like the female, we develop it and work with it. And this is true in many different areas of life. God gave us a Torah, but the Torah doesn't just stay exactly what it was. God empowered us humans to apply our own understanding to it and develop it further and to extract various different laws throughout the generations. So that is like the female taking the seed and cultivating it and developing it and turning it into something totally different and infinitely greater than what you got in the first place. So the relationship of God and the Jewish people being referred to as husband and wife is why, for the most part, in our prayers, we are using male terminology, because it's all in that context. We are talking to God. When we turn to God in prayer and we're asking God to bless us with X, Y, and Z, we're acknowledging that God is the provider. God is the giver. So it's there that we are going to encounter this specific terminology. And perhaps it's a reminder, it's an important reminder. Knowing this tells us that we should always be full of gratitude. We should always realize what our role is and what God's role is and how God is the giver and the provider. We should always acknowledge where our blessings come from, be full of gratitude, and it also helps us maintain a strong measure of humility. So clearly God is genderless. So male is the giver, female is the receiver. When we refer to God in masculine terms, we speak of and to him as the giver. And this is why the vast majority of our prayers use that terminology. Just as in a marriage, both spouses need the other one in order to be complete, God needs us in order to be complete. And this opens up another big idea, which will be addressed more fully in one of the later classes. Because when we say God needs us, what are we saying? It's like saying God is vulnerable. And by definition, when somebody needs somebody or something, it means they don't have it. And that's why they need the other. If God needs us, we're kind of suggesting that God is missing something without us. But that, again, will be addressed later on as well. But we get this reminder that when we are in a relationship, we need each other. Referring to God using masculine terms reminds us of who we are and how much God loves us and needs us. We're going to have just this closing video, and then I'm going to take questions. So An answer to the fourth question, is God a he, a she, or a they? God is neither male nor female, but God manifests in both male and female modalities. Just watch
the basics. One, asking questions about God is not a sign of weakness in belief. Even the ardent believer must do so in an attempt to gain deeper understandings of God. It is important that our relationship with God encompasses our totality, and that our minds should understand what our souls naturally feel. Two, many of our conceptions of God are incorrect and even childish. Like Abraham long ago, we need to first unknow the God of our current perception before we can gain an accurate understanding of the divine. Three, although we can know much about God, he himself is unknowable. The essence of idolatry is the attempt to concretize God and fit him within a familiar framework to create a God in our own image. Four, in Jewish sources, we find depictions of God being located above in the heavens, and we are also told that God is everywhere. While these are both true from a certain perspective, there's a deeper reality. God contains the world, holding all its existence in his space. Everywhere is within God. Five, God's existence is radically different from the existence of all else. All things but God are contingent existences, brought into being by a cause, and by definition, they need not exist. God is a necessary existence, an existence that must be, and therefore has no cause. Six, on an essential level, God transcends gender and is non-binary. Yet God manifests himself in both male and female modalities. When we refer to God in masculine terms, we refer to God as he manifests or behaves in a masculine manner, i.e. as our provider and husband. Doing so places emphasis on our importance to God and our relationship with God.